when Swedish artist and mystic Hilmer af Klimt died in 1944, she left behind more than 1,300 works, and most of them had been seen by only a handful of people. The discovery of her paintings decades later has turned art history on its head, and an exhibition of her work at the Guggenheim in New York was the most visited in the gallery's history, something like 600,000 people, I think. Jennifer Higgy co-authored the book Hilmer af Klimt, Painting the Unseen. She's the producer of podcast series Bow Down, Women in Art History. Her next book features af Klimt. It's called The Other Side, Women, Art and the Spirit World. She's also the author of The Mirror and the Palette, 500 Years of Women's Self-Portraits. And she's with me now. Hello.
Hello, Kim. Thanks very much for having me.
Very good. I saw this exhibition at the City Art Gallery the other day, and it is extraordinary. Can you tell me when you first came upon Hilmer af Klimt?
Well, yeah, it's quite a funny story, actually, because I live in London. I'm Australian, but I live in London. And it was in about 2005, an Australian friend of mine called Donna Huddleston, who's a wonderful artist, put on this very mysterious little exhibition in a sort of an abandoned house in Bloomsbury. And it was called Dear Hilmer. And it was her dedication to Hilmer af Klimt. And I'd never heard of Hilmer af Klimt. And I was like, who on earth is she? And she said, oh, she's this spiritualist and a mystic and this incredible painter. And she had seen some of her paintings in Ireland at a small show in Ireland. Anyway, cut forward to a couple of years, and Camden Art Centre here in London put on a small show of af Klimt. And I went along. And I think since that moment, I've become like an uber fan, because they were just extraordinary. And they were, you know, the main body of work that she's best known for was made between 1906 and 1915. And it's just like nothing else that was being made at the time. And, you know, it does blow art history out of the water, because the idea that a man invented abstraction in 1911, Kandinsky, you know, is just not true. She was making this radical work that very few people were seeing. And it's just, it's joyous, it's strange, it's inventive, it's mysterious. You know, it's infinitely sort of rewarding the longer you spend with it. And then I saw the big show of hers in Sweden at the Moderna Museet as well in 2013.
Gosh, they'd be very proud of her then. Sweden has inserted itself big time into the art history books.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I was talking to a Swedish curator the other day, and he was saying, you know, Hilma's now, you know, our pop star. She's like bigger than ABBA, and she's more famous than the Norwegian monk, you know, and she's replaced Ingmar Bergman in their sort of cultural lexicon.
But didn't the Swedes kind of ignore her and turn her down in her lifetime?
Well, yeah, that's another interesting story, because when she died in 1944, there was some ambiguity around her will, and the story was put out that she said she didn't want her work to be seen for 20 years, which isn't quite true. She just wanted some of the work in her notebooks not to be seen, and she put these very coded messages. But what happened was she left her estate to her nephew, Erik af Klimt, and, you know, there are literally thousands of works, and he was very sympathetic to his aunt's work, but, you know, it's like, what on earth did he do with them? And he knew that they were amazing.
Yeah. But there's an awful, he wouldn't have needed a big shed to put them all in.
He would have needed a very big shed, exactly. And so he went to the Moderna Museet, which is the preeminent modern art museum in Sweden, and asked the then director, who was a guy called Pontus Hultin, this was in 1970, if he would like, he was offering the whole af Klimt estate to the Moderna Museet so that they could look after it and show it and document it and all the rest. And Pontus Hultin apparently didn't even look at the stuff, and turned down on account of the fact that she was a spiritualist, which is crazy considering most modernist artists at the turn of the century were spiritualists.
Were they?
A lot of them were anyway. Yeah, lots of them. I mean, all the big guys who we now know as sort of, you know, the great innovators of abstraction, like Kandinsky, Malevich, Mondrian, Paul Klee, even Munch in his early phase, all of them were into spiritualism in some form or another. You know, Mondrian, for example, had joined the Dutch branch of Theosophy, which was the big mystical movement that was popular at the time that Af Klint was really into. He joined that in 1909. Af Klint didn't join it till, she joined it in 1904 in Sweden. So, you know, a lot of them were looking at the same kinds of things. And Kandinsky and Hilma af Klint actually were in an exhibition together, although it was her more figurative work, not her spiritual work, that was in that show. So we don't know if they met, but that would have been an interesting meeting.
What was the influence of Rudolf Steiner on her work? Because half the time he didn't like it much, and the other half of the time he thought she was a genius.
Well, it's a complicated story, that, because it's not fully documented. And actually, I sat next to a man at dinner the other night, so that was the release of the massive catalogue resume of her work, which is, you know, these seven huge volumes.
Right.
And he's probably the only man who has read, he's Swedish, he's read all 27,000 pages of her notebooks.
Wow.
He said that was his lockdown project. And he cast some light on the Steiner story, because basically he said that she was a huge fan of Steiner. When he left Theosophy, because Theosophy mainly concentrated on the religions of the Eastern world, and he preferred Christianity in the West. And so he broke away from Theosophy and started Anthroposophy. Anyway, Hilma af Klint went to a lot of his lectures and thought he was absolutely marvelous, and he was something of a guru to her. But the thing was that this man the other night at dinner told me was that we've got to remember that Steiner was a superstar, and Hilma af Klint, while we all know now she was a bit of a genius, she wasn't known to anyone then, and she was just another one of many of his incredibly interesting fans. And so while he did pay her some attention, he probably didn't pay the kind of attention that she was probably due, you know, given what we know now of her work. But she did stay in contact with him, and he set up his sort of foundation for Theosophy in a town in Germany called Dornach. And she used to go there a lot with her girlfriend, Thomasine, and they would hang out with Steiner, try to show him her works. She probably wanted to exhibit her works in Dornach, but Steiner didn't. He was encouraging, apparently, but he wasn't wildly enthusiastic, we could say. And anyway, but she apparently, after he died, she kept communicating with him. So that's very useful when you're a spiritualist. It doesn't matter when people die, because you can keep the conversation going. And apparently she kept talking to him in various forms until she died in 1944.
How did she start? Because she didn't just adopt somebody's belief system. She kind of created her own.
Well, it's very interesting, this sort of point in time in terms of spiritualism, because it's an absolute, there were so many belief systems flying around, you know, from Rosicrucianism to Theosophy to Anthroposophy to the Golden Dawn, like all these different belief systems. But what happened with her was she went to art school in Stockholm, and she was a star student, and I really love her figurative works as well, actually. They're really beautiful. And anyway, but when she was there, she started becoming interested in spiritualism, like a lot of people were at that time, because of all these new developments in technology. Things like the X-ray was being invented and radiograms. So what was once invisible was made visible. And so this was used as an argument for spiritualists to say, well, if we can see someone's insides or hear their voice from the other side of the world, well, maybe we can also communicate with the spirit realm.
Ah.
And so she was also very interested in science and as well as spiritualism. And then when she was 17, her sister Hermina died of the flu, actually, of influenza. And obviously Hilma was absolutely devastated. And this only increased her interest in wanting to contact the other side, so that maybe she could, you know, find out if her sister was okay in a different realm, in a different spiritual realm. And so she became very interested in Theosophy, which was started by Madame Blavatsky, a very interesting and complicated woman who was a Russian emigre in New York in the 1860s. And Theosophy was a sort of mishmash of Eastern religions, Christianity, invented ideas about these masters who were directing the world, and all these other belief systems. But so she formed this group of women called the Five, who were all spiritualists. They started having seances, were contacted by masters, and then they started making their drawings. So it is a complicated story.
Does one, Jennifer, have to buy in to that kind of spiritualism in order to appreciate her work?
You know, I think that's such a good idea, a good question, rather. And I think the idea of her work, or my reading of it, is that she really believed, she had this sort of utopian idea of art to be able to communicate something wonderful without people necessarily knowing the details of precisely what it was she was communicating. And ironically, she often didn't know what she was communicating, because she said she was, you know, a conduit for the spirits. And she spent the rest of her life trying to understand herself what it was she had created. So, I think the idea is a bit like, to understand a beautiful piece of music, you don't need to know what key it was written in. You know, I think her work is a bit like that. It's so joyful. It is so beautiful. There is something about it that even the uninitiated, someone who has no interest in spiritualism, can see these things and appreciate them for the beautiful things that they are. I mean, I've known people to sort of weep in front of them, without people who have no interest in spiritualism, because these works they're about the creative spirit and the mysteries of the mind, and in that they're very sort of joyful, I think.
Tell me how the paintings for the temple came about.
Well, in 1906, Hilma and her group of five, the five women that she worked with, she was contacted by us called Amalio.
Who were the other five, by the way? Were they also artists who deserve some kind of rediscovery?
Yeah. The main one was this girl called Anna Cassell, who was an artist who Hilma had been friends with at her art school, and they were very close. And then the other three they'd met actually at another spiritualist group called the Edelweiss Society. And one of them, I can't remember her name, but one of them actually was the initial artist in the group who was mainly contacted by, she was the main artist medium. And I'm not sure if the other two were artists. They were more interested in spiritualism, I think, than artists themselves.
Right.
I need to check that, actually. Anyway, so then in 1906, Hilma was contacted by this spirit called Amalio, and he says that he has a huge commission for her, you know, and it's going to be a lot of work, and it will astound humanity. And so from then on, from 1906 to 1908, she worked on the spirit. So the paintings for the temple, which were the works she worked on from 1906 to 1915, they're a huge body of work, but within that body of work, there's a lot of sort of subgroups like Eros, Swans, a tree of life, lots of different sort of the 10 largest, which is about the different stages of a person's life from birth to death. And so she worked on these paintings. So she laid out enormous pieces of paper on the floor. She was sort of like a cosmic Jackson Pollock. And she, on some of them, there are footprints. So she probably walked across them, maybe in her stocking feet as she painted them. One of the other women helped her occasionally because they were so enormous, these works. And she stopped in 1908 for 2 years to look after her mother, who was going blind. And then she came back, and then she completed the work in 1915. And so it's a staggering body of work. And at one stage, she actually designed a temple that she wanted to show the work in, but that was never realized.
And so at the exhibition that we have at the City Gallery, we have the centrepiece, which is a series of three paintings. If people go on our webpage, they can have a look at it. And they are the most kind of enormous and beautiful paintings. Can you talk to us about those?
I don't have my laptop in front of me, so I'm not quite sure which
no,
three they are.
No, they're the ones, it's a kind of a triptych, and it's, I haven't got the labels on them, so I don't know what they're called. It's like a pyramid with a huge kind of sun thing on top of it. And then there's a thing that looks like Jupiter on top of an upside down pyramid, and then there's a big sun thing. Does this mean anything?
Yeah, I do know which ones you mean.
These are the paintings for the temple, I imagine, or at least some of them.
The paintings for the temple, right? And so with these, she was she was wanting to, in a sense, create an idea for where these pictures might be displayed. And she had this idea for the temple. And the temple, I mean, the language that she used in all of her works, you know, it's still being decoded. Like, so every color that she used had some kind of meaning. Every shape that she used had another meaning. But sort of boiling it all down to sort of essentials, she was basically looking at the alchemical idea of a unity within difference. She felt that the world had sort of separated into too many divisions between light and dark, men and women, war and peace. And with her work, she was trying to create images that embraced or embodied the idea of unity and balance and calm and harmony. And so in a sense, that's what she's trying to do in each of her pictures. And with the idea of the temple, she wants to create a space which is literally to worship this idea of unity, calm, peace and harmony. So, but, you know, I think you have to be wary too, or I have to be wary of being too reductive about what she was trying to do, because they're very complex pictures. And I think that, you know, I think they're pictures that are very open to however you want to respond to them too, is you know, they sort of get to you emotionally before almost they get to you intellectually. And I think that's part of their power.
What started her rediscovery? What kicked this off? Because it's happened quite suddenly. I mean, when I was at the City Gallery, there are a myriad of books about her. All of a sudden, everybody's writing about Hilma af Klint.
Yeah, I mean, it really has taken off over the last few years, but it did really start there were a few art historians who went against the canon, you know, who went against this modernist idea of, you know, that abstraction started with Kandinsky. And, you know, they kept saying, but what about Hilma af Klint? And it mainly came from the Swedes, because obviously they had access to her work and they were the only ones who had seen it. But then in 1983, the brilliant American curator Morris Tuckman included Hilma af Klint's work in a massive show he did on the spiritual in art. And at that time, he was doing something very unusual, which was including mediumistic art and art that might be considered outsider art, I hate that word, to be part of the modernist canon, which is absolutely correct, I think. And so he put Hilma's work in this show at LACMA in Los Angeles. And people were like, oh, my God, what is this? And so for the first time, she was seen outside of Sweden and she was seen, you know, in the context of modern art. But, you know, that was an incredibly radical show and it was a brilliant show. The catalogue, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's got some amazing essays in it. It's quite hard to get now. But it was slow, but it was sort of the trickle that became, you know, the raging river, because some artists saw that, like an artist in America called R.H. Quaitman. She saw Hilma's work and she started referencing Hilma's work and putting her in exhibitions. And then there was exhibitions at the Douglas Hyde in Ireland, at Camden Arts Centre here in London. Then, of course, the big one was the Moderne Musik Show in 2013, which was the biggest show devoted to Hilma af Klint's work. And that had a wonderful sort of justice to it as well, because, of course, you know, in 1970, as I mentioned, Pontus Hultin, the then director of the Moderne Musik, had rejected her work. And so the director of the Moderne Musik at that point, Daniel Birnbaum, he was a massive fan of her work, and he's now one of the co-editors of her catalogue, Raisonné. And so he staged this incredible exhibition. And so I went to Stockholm to see it, and I honestly think it was the most extraordinary thing I'd ever seen. I was almost falling over.
Really?
It was a beautiful exhibition.
Wow.
And then that everyone went to that show, and it was like that became a huge hit, and then that show toured, and then it, you know, now it's what it is. She's a superstar.
I'm glad you told me that you hated the expression outsider art, because it's on the tip of my tongue to ask you whether you think Hilma af Klint is an outsider artist.
No. Yeah, no, I do.
She really has been, though, right?
Well, that's how she's been. Well, I don't think anyone would say it now, but she has been definitely sort of lumped into that awful category. And, you know, I think...
Why is it awful? I mean, doesn't it just signify that there are people doing things that are for no particular virtue, excluded from the canon. It's a badge. Mm. It's a badge now, isn't it? Rather than a stigma.
Well, it implies that there's an inside and an outside.
Well, there is.
History. Well, that's changing though now, and with shows like Hilmer af Klint, it's challenging this traditional canon that there is an inside and an outside. And one of the wonderful things that's happening now, I think, that it's becoming very apparent that art history is a work in progress and that art history should reflect humanity in all of its messy glory. You know, it should have people who have been trained, not necessarily at art schools. It should have people of all genders and sexualities and cognitive abilities and physical abilities. So I think this idea of a much more inclusive art history. I mean, the idea that, you know, Hilmer af Klint was very well trained at an art school and won prizes, yet she was considered outsider, probably because of her gender, really, more than anything, because women weren't particularly included in art history.
Well, they weren't. I mean, I think it's been pointed out that the first edition of Gombrich's The Story of Art had not one woman artist in it.
Exactly.
But at the same time...
And neither did Janssen's History of Art. The two biggest best-selling textbooks of art history that I studied when I was at art school, neither of them had one woman in them in their first editions of the 50s and 60s.
But at the same time, you know, we've had Frida Kahlo and Leonora Carrington and Lee Krasner and Louise Bourgeois... And they were, I mean, Marcel Duchamp said women artists, Peggy Guggenheim, you ought to exhibit them. It's not like they didn't have champions. What was the blockage? Was it just sheer misogyny?
Well, you know, obviously in the 20th century, things have changed. Although, you know, it's really only taken to the last 10 years where museums are really properly putting on big survey shows of women artists, which is great. But, you know, so pre-20th century, obviously women had no political agency. Many of them weren't allowed into art schools until even the 20th century. You know, the Germany, you couldn't go to an art school as a woman until 1919, a state-run art school, that is. There were private art schools. So, you know, women had so much against them. You know, before they had birth control, if they had children, they ended up running the family and, you know, looking after kids. I mean, that still happens, I know, among so many of my friends who have children and artists. So it's very difficult. So, you know, art history was very patriarchal. It was written in the main by white men about other white men. And of course, women have had champions and there have always been women making art. You know, I was amazed when I started doing my book, The Mirror and the Palette, to discover how many women, you know, were working as professional artists in the Renaissance in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. And often some of them were very famous in their day. But almost as soon as they died, unless their work was really clearly signed, their work was often misattributed to male artists and they were written out of the story. I mean, it happened time and again. It's, you know, the omission of art, of women from art history, it isn't a theory, it's a fact. And it's a rather staggering one. But things are changing now, thank goodness.
The title of your book, The Mirror and the Palette, relates to the fact that women weren't allowed to paint naked models, so they painted themselves. If they had a mirror and a palette, they could paint themselves. And so you got a lot of self-portraits. But Hilmer af Klint, maybe she did one or two self-portraits. Her mind was elsewhere, wasn't it?
It was definitely elsewhere. Yeah, she wasn't interested in you know, representing the so-called real world. She was interested in spirit, not matter. And, you know, she wasn't, I don't think, a vain person either. She wasn't, not that self-portraiture is a vain project, but, you know, I don't think she was particularly interested in her own features. She was interested in what was happening inside her skull and what was happening in the world of spirits and energy, not her physical realm. Really.
Do you think, what do you think she would have been like to have, you know, a conversation with?
Oh, I think she would have been fascinating. I mean, she was a very interesting woman. She was a very radical woman. She was most likely a queer woman. She was a vegetarian from a really early age. She was obviously extremely independent. She never married. She never had children. She, you know, she to be able to live such a radical life at a time when you have very little agency over your own body as a woman was an incredibly bold thing to do, you know. And I think she would have, it would have been interesting to know what she would have been like outside of her spiritual circles, because she was obviously so deeply invested in her spiritual community. It'd be interesting to know how she would have behaved in sort of regular, you know, a regular party filled with atheists. I don't know. Yeah. But she obviously was absolutely fascinating. And, you know, she was such a persistent analyzer of her own world, you know, 27,000 pages of notebooks.
Those notebooks are extraordinary. I mean, they're scrupulously detailed. I can't understand Swedish, but they look, you know, like they are writing. They're what are they doing? It's like a kind of speculative fiction, if you like. I'm hoping to talk to Nora Jemison in a moment, but she's created this whole world in the paintings, and she's backed it up with this extraordinary detailed description in the notebooks. Is that what they are?
Yeah. I mean, her notebooks are as much about her trying to understand what she does as explaining to someone else what they are. You know, they're like, I mean, it's hard for me to understand any of them because obviously they're in Swedish. And so, and only some of them have been translated. But, you know, it was actually talking to this man, the co-editor of the Catalogue Raisonné, the only man in person in existence who's read all 27,000 pages. And he said, you know, she was very lively in the notebooks as well. And, you know, she's very, for example, unabashed about sleeping with women, for example, which was interesting because I hadn't heard that before. So she's bold, she's analytical, she's self-critical, she's modest too. There's something quite modest about her, I think. I don't think she...
That seems odd to call her modest, because she clearly thinks she's got, you know, a channel to the stars in some way, and she's been chosen. She's been chosen by these spiritual beings to express what they are saying. That would seem to give somebody a sense of self-importance, would it not?
Yeah, but you compare her to the spiritualist artists at the same time, like, you know, the ones I mentioned before, like Kandinsky, Mondrian, Malevich, Paul Klee, all of them, like, and they're all in the same, they're all drinking from the same spiritual well. But what they're doing is they're constantly, you know, badgering people for exhibitions and publishing manifestos and having articles written about them and going to all the best openings so that they meet the most important people. You know, they're very good at self-promotion. And she wasn't. You know, she loved Steiner and he was her guru. But apart from Steiner, she wasn't out selling herself to a million and one people, you know, in terms of wanting to get her, she wanted to get her work out there, but only to people who were sympathetic to what she was doing. I don't think she was particularly interested in a general public, you know, in just becoming a superstar in the way those other artists were. And that's what I mean by modesty. I think she was very aware of her own power, but she wasn't a trumpet blower, maybe.
So
I could
when,
be totally wrong.
well, I mean, I guess... I don't know. If she'd been a trumpet blower, we might have known more about her earlier. I don't know.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
When it is said that her rediscovery has turned art history on its head, beyond saying, as the City Gallery's promotion says, before Malevich, before Kandinsky, before Mondrian, there was Hilmer, beyond just saying that, like she got there first... What does that really mean, turning art history on its head? Or is that a bit of artistic license, as it were?
No, I think they're absolutely right by saying that. Because basically, the way abstraction has traditionally been taught, it came from Alfred J. Barr, who was the director of the Museum of Modern Art in New York when it was first when the collection was first put together. And in 1936, he staged a show of abstract art, and he wrote a catalogue for that. And in the essay that he wrote, even though he knew that a lot of these artists were, that like Kandinsky and Malevich, were inspired by spiritualism, he basically poo-pooed that and famously wrote, or rather infamously wrote, these artists have turned to abstraction because they're tired of subject matter, which is such a misreading. I mean, it's just a false reading. His idea was that abstraction was about modernity, which was about looking to the future, which was about getting rid of narrative and religion, and all of the 19th century sort of concerns around possibly spirits or emotion. You know, he saw abstraction as formalism. And so this was the way abstraction was taught to generations of art historians. And even the idea of Kandinsky, everyone knew that he wrote on the spirits within art. I mean, that's unequivocal. But they sort of see it as a youthful aberration, which is, again, a misreading, because he was interested in spiritualism throughout his life. And so, and of course, Alfred J. Barr didn't include any women in his theatre. There were a couple maybe of Russian women, maybe suprematists, but that was about it. Otherwise, it's all men. It's all about his idea of formalism. And, you know, he doesn't mention the spirit world at all. He doesn't mention that so many artists in the 19th century, their art was fueled by spiritualism, and this directly led to abstraction. So, and also, you know, he also, of course, but this is another huge subject, didn't include indigenous art and, you know, the ideas of abstraction being actually extremely complex, codified maps of land and thinking, you know. So it was also a very sort of white and patriarchal reading of art history. So, you know, if you bring Hilmer into this and you say, well, look, someone was doing this kind of work before the guys, and it was fueled by spiritualism, not by formalism, well, then it blows that whole canon aside. I mean, famously, Rosalind Krauss, the brilliant art theorist, she wrote in 1979 in her famous essay on the grid that to mention spiritualism and art in one sentence would be deeply embarrassing to most art historians. You know, this is only, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Exciting times. Nice to talk to you, Jennifer Heggie.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Talking about the Hilmer F. Klint, the exhibition of her work has just opened at the City Gallery in Wellington, and you can get a taste of it on our webpage.